Since once again I failed to set the little recording device correctly at the class on Monday night, this time what I'm going to do is substitute a fairly extended podcast, which I hope to go over all or certainly at least most of the material that was covered during the class. I'm recording it while sitting in the repair lobby at a police Toyota. So if you hear any odd background noise, it's undoubtedly the so-called news that's being broadcast early in the morning over the TVs which surround me. What we're looking at tonight are several of the I'll say limiting doctrines in the field of contract remedies. They are limitations on, or maybe they simply explain better, what the courts have meant by the term expectation. When we say that we're going to put the aggrieved party in the position the aggrieved party was would have been in had the contract been performed, we have to confront at the same time some clear limitations which the courts have put not so much on the reach of what we've described as direct damages, but those that are consequential. Of course, they must be caused by the breach, and that is one of the standards we talked about on last night. That is, that one of the requirements is that in order to recover damages, the aggrieved party is going to have to show that the losses that they're describing and about which they're giving evidence are in fact losses which were caused by the breach. That is clear at both common law, and it's also true in the language of 2715, which talks about the losses as a result of the breach. The word result, of course, is also a word that describes a causal relationship between the breach on the one hand and the loss on the other. We did look at a number of cases in the casebook which have the courts addressing the issue of cause and acknowledging that very seldom in life is a single event the cause of a particular result that we're looking at. That is, that it could be the dominant cause, or it could be a relatively minor cause. Furthermore, the other causes may be causes which are entirely outside of the relationship between the two contracting parties, or it may be as a result of some action of the party who would describe themselves as the aggrieved party, but whose conduct may have contributed to the loss. And so the courts have to resolve those various situations, and they have done it in the main by requiring they do not require that the loss be solely caused by the breach, but they do require that the breach be a predominant cause. And in a few instances, if the other part of the cause or another part of the cause is some action on the part of the aggrieved party, the court may in fact reach to distribute the loss in the sense that they apportion it and only provide to the aggrieved plaintiff that part of the loss which they think was the result of the conduct of the breaching party, and not that part of the loss which they think was clearly the responsibility of the aggrieved party. It gets more difficult, of course, in a situation in which you find that there may be several causes, but the court will then describe perhaps that the dominant cause was the breach. Under those circumstances, they will award the entire loss that's proved against the breaching defendant. Anyway, so much for cause. It's a relatively minor doctrine in the casebook because, frankly, the number of cases describing a problem about cause is relatively few. by and large, in breach of contract cases, the courts are looking at cases in which it's pretty obvious that the dominant cause of the loss was, in fact, the breach of contract. The far more important limiting doctrines, and we did address these, partly in our previous class and partly last night, were foreseeability, a very important limitation, which we need to understand as well as we can, and the doctrine of certainty. And those two occupied most of our time last night. With respect to foreseeability, of course, we saw the basic rule, which courts say they continue to adhere to, the case of Hadley versus Baxendale. And we began to look at the question about whether or not the courts really were deciding Hadley versus Baxendale on the ground that the particular loss which the mill had experienced as a result of the shipment delay, whether that loss was, quote, foreseeable at the time the contract was made. And the Hadley versus Baxendale is said to have touched on two different kinds of foreseeability, and they are both part of our current Hadley versus Baxendale or foreseeability rule. One of them is whether or not the loss, which was one that would have occurred and would have been foreseeable in the ordinary course of events. That is, that any reasonable people thinking about entering into the transaction at the time these parties entered into the transaction would have been able to foresee this loss. I should say that the courts do make clear, and I think I did not make this clear enough last night, that when we talk about foreseeability of the loss, we don't mean foreseeability of the amount of the loss. Instead, we mean foreseeability of the kind of loss. And that's pretty consistent throughout the cases, kind rather than amount. So it's possible that this kind of loss could have been foreseen as occurring in the ordinary course of events, that and the parties could have, should have foreseen it at the time the contract was made. The second is a different kind of foreseeability. That's foreseeability based upon specific knowledge, which the breaching party had about the losses that would occur to the aggrieved party in the event of a breach. Now, this is a somewhat more difficult problem, at least in the factual context of Hadley versus Baxendale, because at least one version of the story is that, in fact, the agent for the mill did, in fact, tell the railroad agent that the mill was shut down because this was their only shaft, and they had to send the broken shaft off to a company that was going to use it to construct a new shaft for them. And I and a lot of other people have real doubt that any information of that kind, no matter how imparted to the agent, the ticket agent, would in fact have made any difference to the court at all, even though that would be special knowledge on the basis of which you could foresee what in fact did happen. That is, that the mill was shut down for an extended period of time because of the failure to deliver the shaft promptly. I pointed out that Section 352 of the Restatement is quite interesting. It is the embodiment of the rule of Hadley versus Baxendale, except that they've added a Section 3, which I think few courts have directly addressed since that became included in the Restatement Second. But it, in effect, acknowledges, at least I read it this way, it acknowledges that the courts may sometimes refuse to grant damages under this rule if the damages seem to them to be disproportionate to the value of the contract. And I think, in fact, that explains Hadley versus Baxendale and a number of other cases involving carriers who are, after all, under the rule of common carriage, required to carry the goods, whether they be railroads or truckers telecommunications companies. They are what are known as common carriers, and they cannot refuse carriage as long as somebody's going to pay them for it. they can't refuse it. Or the grounds upon which they can refuse it are severely constricted, things like inherently dangerous and so on. But otherwise, they are required to carry them. And so they have no real choice. And I think that the value of the contract, of course, in all of those cases, as it was in Hadley versus Baxendale, the value of the contract, that is the cost of transportation, which is the value to the breaching party, is really just a tiny fraction of the potential loss if they fail to deliver the goods on time. In any event, the courts have had to cope with the question of the application of this doctrine of Hadley versus Baxendale in a myriad of circumstances, and we read just a few to give some flavor of what the difficulties are and how the courts go about it. One of the principal problems that the courts have dealt with has been the question of how foreseeable the event was. And by that, the courts mean how probable the result was, how probable that degree of loss was based upon, or that kind of loss was, at the time that the contract was made. And so we looked at the case of Victoria Laundry, where the court wrestles with the question of the measurement of the extent of liability of a boiler manufacturer, a water boiler manufacturer, when through a series of events they managed to deliver the boiler to the buyer, who was a laundry launderer, very late. And the question is how to measure the loss that was the result of the delay. There was no doubt about the breach. There was no doubt about the fact that there was a loss caused by it. But the question is, how do you measure that loss? And the court, in effect, had two different kinds of losses, as they saw it, that were described. One loss was a loss in the amount of laundry, which or the profit that they would have experienced on the amount of laundry that they could have washed had the additional boiler been delivered in a timely way, as compared to how much they, in fact, did make because they didn't have the extra boiler. A second element of damage had to do, since they also did cloth dyeing, how much additional cloth they would have dyed and what the profit would have been on that additional cloth. The third element of damage was a specific contract apparently being issued by the state for a dyeing contract. And I guess that that was a particularly profitable one. The court doesn't tell us. But we do know that the aggrieved buyer very much wanted that loss to be included. And the court, for a variety of reasons, apparently, decides that that would not be included within what was foreseeable, so that the general laundry, additional laundry they could have washed, or the cloth, additional cloth they could have dyed, would be included, but the specific contract would not be, presumably on the ground that that would not fall either within the ordinary course rule, and they had failed to provide evidence that there was specific information on the part of the boiler manufacturer about that public contract. I might add that the additional issue, one will really address under the title certainty, comes because of the question of whether or not, in fact, this particular aggrieved buyer would have been the recipient of that contract, even had the boiler been delivered. But let's leave that until we address the question of certainty. The Kufos case was one in which the court had to address the question of whether or not the late arrival of a boat carrying sugar, that was clearly a breach, and the court doesn't doubt that. I don't think it was even contested in the litigation, or certainly not at this stage of the litigation. This is a remedy issue. And the ship owner said, well, you know, the price of sugar rises and falls, and they're not really responsible for the fact that when the ship actually arrived, that the price of sugar was down, and therefore the sale price of the sugar when it arrived at the port was lower than the price would have been had they arrived 9 days earlier, and their view was that it was at least as likely that the price would have been higher as it was that it would have been lower. Notwithstanding that argument, which seems relatively persuasive, the court said, no, we don't think that that's right. And in doing it, they try to define what they mean by what you could foresee. And they look at the rules as developed in Victoria Laundry, and they look at rules as developed in tort law as compared to contract law. And they seem to like phrases like liable to result and real danger and serious possibility. They seem to be a little more reluctant to accept a phrase that Judge Asquith had used in Victoria Laundry, quote, on the cards, unquote. And in exploring the on the cards, they have a particularly interesting observation, because the question is, well, what does that mean? If somebody says, they say, that it's probable that the next card that you pick up from a shuffled deck of cards will be a diamond, because, after all, there's a 1 in 4 or 25% chance that it will be a diamond. But if you said that it would be the ace of diamonds, well, then the chance of that occurring would be 1 out of 52. So a far lower percentage, 2% or something. And so that suggests that a 25% probability is sufficient to bring it within the ordinary course rule of Hadley versus Baxendale. And I'm not so sure that that the courts would agree with that. But I suppose you would say that, even as described by the ship owner in Kufos, that there was a 50% chance that the price of sugar would be lower on the day that they brought in the sugar, their ship came into port at a point that the sugar price was lower. There was at least a 50% possibility or probability that it would be lower, and that that would be sufficient to meet the cause requirement as they saw it. And then we also looked at the Martinez case, and that the Martinez case is one in which, like Hadley versus Baxendale, we have a carrier, and the carrier is carrying goods. In this case, it was a drag line, a strip mining machinery, and they were shipping it from Ohio to Eagle Pass, Texas. And they had to load it on 5 separate railroad cars. I guess it's a very large piece of equipment. And the 5 cars were shipped separately, and the last car with the last piece, and apparently all the pieces were necessary for the machine to work as a whole, was a month late. And the question was how to assess the damages for the month late. And interestingly enough, I think the buyer had decided to ask only for rental. That is, the rental value of the equipment, which had been lost for 1 month by reason of the breach of contract and late delivery. And the court embraces that as a something which really should have been foreseen. And notice that the court did not require evidence that they had intended to rent it, or that there was specific knowledge they intended to rent it. Indeed, there's no evidence of any specific knowledge on the carrier at all. But they said that surely that was a foreseeable harm, a clearly foreseeable harm, and therefore is within the scope of Hadley versus Baxendale. That would have suggested, as applied to Hadley versus Baxendale, for example, that if there was a rental value of the shaft, that they should have awarded to the aggrieved mill owner the rental value of the shaft for the period of delay. And that would be true, you see, in the view of the court in Martinez. That would have been true even if, had there been no specific knowledge on the part of the shipper. An interesting rule. And then I think the last case that we looked at, the Panhandle Agro Service versus Becker is really a looked at again at 2715, which we've looked at again and again. We saw the 2715 says that at least for consequential damages, which buyers are entitled to against sellers, that the rule, essentially the rule of Hadley versus Baxendale, has to be observed. That is, that the aggrieved party must show not only there was a causal relationship between the breach and the loss, but also that the loss was foreseeable at the time the contract was made. There are several cases on causation. I really covered those in my remarks already on this podcast. That is, that the cause has to be a substantial part of the cause. It doesn't have to be the only cause. But on the other hand, the court may reduce the amount of damages if they find that some part of the cause was due to the aggrieved party's conduct. But if they decide that it's a substantial cause and the other the other contributing causes were not activity on the part of the breaching party, the fact that it's a substantial cause is sufficient to warrant the award of damages on the basis of the applicable expectation remedy. That is, the amount necessary to put the aggrieved party in the position they would have been had the contract been performed. Now, the other, the next subject we dealt with is as important a limitation, maybe in some ways a more important limitation than the limitation of foreseeability. But, or you can argue that maybe it's embraced within the concept of foreseeability, and that is the concept of certainty. How certain is it that a particular loss would have occurred, or that that measurement would itself have been foreseeable? But the courts have not addressed it under the doctrine of foreseeability, but instead the doctrine of certainty, which may have more to do with the court's ability to form a persuasive judgment about the amount of loss. That is, that the court's desire is, after all, to compensate. That is, to put the aggrieved party in the position they would have been in had the contract been performed. But it's not to punish. It's, after all, a compensatory notion and not one that's punitive in character. So that said, you get a case like Kenford, the Buffalo Domed Stadium case, in which the aggrieved party would have had a management contract for a 20-year period for a domed stadium. The domed stadium was never built, and so we can't look at the actual experience of whoever did get to manage the domed stadium, because there never was a domed stadium in Buffalo and still isn't. So the question for the court was, how much do we give them? The lawyers for the aggrieved plaintiff had had economists construct a model which showed year by year, in their view, how much money the aggrieved plaintiff would have made each year for the 20 years. And the court looked at it and expressed its admiration for the care and thoughtfulness and inventiveness of the economists who had come up with this 20-year model. But they said, in the end, we're just not persuaded that it meets a, quote, reasonable certainty standard. In doing it, they reject an alternative that some courts had used of, quote, rational basis. They say, no, it's not a rational basis. That itself is not enough. What is required is a reasonable certainty. And they found that here there were just too many variables that were uncertain, that they weren't quite guesswork, but they were too uncertain. The only model at that time that the economists had to work with was the Houston Stadium, the Astrodome, and the court obviously was not persuaded that the experience in Buffalo would be the same as the experience in Texas, and so that this effort failed. And I speculated that perhaps they would have gotten a better result if the economists had tried to build a model for, let's say, 5 years, which would have might have found more credibility on the part of the court to believe that you could predict the loss for 5 years than predicting the loss for 20 years. But who knows? This is a problem, actually, which occurs again and again in the case of what some courts have called the new business rule. Most courts have rejected it and rejected that terminology in the current jurisprudence. But certainly, if you take a look at the cases as a whole and remedy, you discover that there is a distinct problem when you're dealing with a brand new business. The problem being that you don't have a track record to go on. If I can't prove the way in which my client profited in similar transactions in the past, it will be much more difficult for me to prove that my client has to be given a profit based upon something. And so if you can show, oh, well, my client had a contract just like this a year ago, and this is the amount of profit that he made, and therefore this contract, which is quite like the old contract, this contract, which has been breached, he would have gotten a similar profit and sue for the profit based upon that analysis. But if it's a brand new business, you, of course, can't do that. Now, the question is, how far will the court move beyond the identical experience in the past? And for that, we looked at Ashland Management versus Janian, a case in which the court did, in fact, award damages to a computer programmer by the name of Janian, who was dismissed by Ashland Management in breach of contract. And when he sued for damages, what he did is he argued that the contract itself has provisions which contain an estimate by the company of the kind of money that they expected to make as a result of this employment contract. And it also had figures for how much they would have to pay Janian even if, in breach of contract, he left Ashland's employment. And so with those numbers, the court said, well, we can use those numbers to find the damages which Janian is entitled against Ashland, to entitle against Ashland when Ashland breached the contract. And so this shows that while courts are wary of arguments about loss of profitability of a new business, it's possible that they may be persuaded if the figures are concrete enough and can be sufficiently related to this particular event, they might be persuaded to go ahead and grant damages even though it is a new business. So what that charges us with, to move it beyond the Jamian case, is to say that we want to be able, and looking at the Kenford case as well, we want to be able to show at least businesses that are as similar as possible to the one that our client is in, and to show some consistency of the profitability of those ventures, and then try to induce the court to accept it in our case. Now, I didn't say this last night, I should have, that one of the influences in the evolution of this rule away from the new business rule has been found in antitrust law. Now, antitrust law is at heart, obviously, not contract law. It's actually a derivative of tort law. But frequently in antitrust cases, one of the problems is that a plaintiff is arguing that because of the monopolistic behavior of the defendant, it has been impossible for them to enter the business. And if it's been impossible for them to enter the business, that means, of course, that they have no basis for showing what the loss of profitability is when they were prevented from entering the business. And so the courts have had to be willing to construct some way of analyzing what the cost would be, what the loss of would be. And indeed, in antitrust law, you then treble it because they're entitled to three times that amount as a result of the antitrust statutes. But the willingness of courts in those cases to try to construct a loss of profit for a brand new enterprise has, I think, influenced contract cases to giving the court more confidence that they can come up with a figure for loss, even though it's a, quote, new business. And then finally, we looked at two, I would say, inherently risky kinds of contracts in which you'd think that loss was very difficult to estimate. One involving horse racing, the Rumbola case, and the other involved the pop music recording, that Contemporary Mission versus Famous Music Corporation. And we saw that in both those cases, the courts were willing to accept the figures offered by the plaintiff, even though you'd have to say that there was a significant risk that, in fact, that it would not have been nearly as profitable as the courts ended up saying that they thought this was, and therefore the loss was somewhat chancy. Now, here you notice, though, that it's not the character of the loss. It was perfectly clear that there would be a loss in, what shall I say, revenues from successful horse racing, that there would be a loss in revenues from successful sales of records, that what they were really arguing about was the amount of the loss. And so what that tells you is that the greater the certainty is of the kind of loss, perhaps the less concerned the court is going to be about the exact measurement of the riskiness, particularly if they have a fairly concrete way of measuring it. They're prepared to accept the notion that there was some risk that, in fact, the horse would have stopped winning, or the horse could have been injured, obviously, or that the record may not have had the same success as extrapolation from the losses that extrapolation from the gains in sales that other records have had at a similar state of distribution, as that described in Contemporary Mission versus Famous Music Corporation. As I say, in general, the rules of uncertainty have varied and have evolved over time. And as we become more sophisticated at prediction with respect to the potential profitability of commercial contracts, the courts have moved with it and been willing to accept evidence of a perhaps less specific kind than they had demanded in the past. If I look back at the Kenford case, and this the essay in your casebook suggests this, you'd say, well, look, this is grossly unfair to deny them any recovery just because of uncertainty. There is some level at which you have enough certainty. If you predict the profits low enough, if you predict the probability of those profits low enough, you still come up with a possibility of loss that should have been recognized by the court. The result of saying, no, you get nothing, is really an unacceptable result. And I suggested, the essay does not, but I suggested that I think in part here this was overreaching on the part of the plaintiff's attorneys, that if they had kept that model to a showing of 5 years of loss, that they would have had a substantially better chance of recovering, even had their only, quote, evidence, unquote, been the econometric model constructed by the economists in that case. Finally, the material in Section 6 on damages for mental distress, I suggest that you come away with it with only this degree of understanding, that contracts, courts have generally not favored granting mental distress damages. That's unlike torts. The cases in which the courts have been willing to grant damages for mental distress are limited to those contracts in which the central concern of the contract is thought to be peace of mind, mental concern and solicitude, some courses say. So that the cases that have predominated in this field are those things like perpetual care contracts for graves, contracts involving promises by doctors to be present at the delivery of a child, or contracts with a woman that promise that there will be a cesarean section and there's not. Or a case that I didn't talk about last night, but I certainly should have, Lane versus KinderCare Learning Centers, in which a child, a very small child, had been left with the child care, and they managed to close up the child care center, I guess late in the afternoon or evening, without ever notifying the mother. They had locked the baby, in effect, into the darkened facility. They had had some medication, which were supposed to provide for the child with the consent of the mother, and they had failed to do that, and the court, in combination, it was too much for the court. They ordered mental distress damage to be paid. The child, fortunately, was fine. And there have been some cases involving contracts for tour companies that have arranged for tours that have made all kinds of promises about how wonderful and glorious a vacation that you're going to have. And there have been some fairly extreme cases of breaches in this kind of area. And at least some courts have been willing to grant mental distress damages for the experience, the frustrations and unhappiness that necessarily accompany an expensive but very bad vacation, where the problem was clearly the fault of the tour guide. That is, that the tour company had failed to provide promised facilities or promised travel arrangements. And there are both some primarily English cases, but some American cases that have done that. And one case that's in the case book, a very interesting one that we did not get to last night. My apologies for that. Deitch versus Music Company, in which the music company agreed to provide a four-piece band for their wedding reception from 8 p.m. to midnight, and the band never arrived. And the court says, oh, the plaintiffs are entitled to compensation for distress and inconvenience and the diminution in value of their reception. So at least in part, it was $750 damage. So in part, the court attributed that to mental distress. It is, of course, quite difficult to figure out what economic losses would have occurred to the wedding couple as a result of the failure of the band to show up. Clearly, if they had paid the band in advance, they would have been entitled to their money back. But the problem of trying to figure out otherwise what losses they had is difficult. Notice that in these emotional distress cases, that there is no doubt in the mind of the court about the fact that they meet the foreseeability test. They certainly have some problems with the certainty test, but rather than rest upon certainty, these cases, a special class of cases, rest upon the nature of the damage itself. That is, what's claimed as an emotional distress rather than economic loss. And contract damages are really primarily aimed at trying to compensate for economic loss. I think that with that, I'll end this podcast. I believe that I've covered all or most of the material covered last night. My apologies for failing to record it successfully, but I hope that this will be a satisfactory substitute for that, and I'll try to make sure that I do an adequate recording job on Thursday evening. Just a reminder, that examination, practice examination question, I don't really regard that as discretionary on your part. I want you to submit it. I confess that I have no particular sanctions that I'm proposing against it. The real sanctions are ones you're imposing on yourself. Your failure to have the benefits of the experience of taking the practice examination are likely to harm you when it comes to the examination itself. And I pointed out that you get an immediate response, something that will never happen otherwise in law school to an examination, because as soon as you send me your answer to the practice examination question, I will immediately email back to you a username and password that will allow you to unlock what is otherwise a locked file. And in unlocking it, you will have the benefits of looking at a sample answer to that question, and then you can go ahead and compare what you've said to the sample answer. Now, it's not the only answer, but it is a sample of a kind of a good answer to the practice examination question that I gave you. And I will also give you some additional feedback. I have not yet quite decided what the form of that feedback will be, but it will either be something in writing, or it will be a kind of oral response of the kind that I provided to the last practice that the class did for me. I'll see you Thursday night.